present.
Good afternoon. Senate Judiciary Committee is in order. We are going to reorder the agenda a bit to accommodate the presence of some witnesses that came from some great distance today. So we're going to start with Senate File 196, Senator Ingebrigtsen's bill. And then we're going to go on to Senate File 187. Senator Franz and I saw you were here as well. You'll be third on the agenda. We're anticipating going until about 10 to 3 today, since we have the room for some time, but another committee is here after 3 o'clock. So we'll get in. We're here to the electors bill that is not going to be heard today due to time limitations. We'll probably take that up on Tuesday.
Sorry.
Inconvenience to folks. We can't control how long the floor session runs. So for now, we're going to take up Senator Ingebrigtsen's bill, Senate File 196. Back to the committee, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's good to get back to the committee. As you know, I was on this committee for, I think, since the beginning of my career down here 6 years ago, and it's good to get back. And I really appreciate the fact that you take into consideration our testifier. She's a little further out than me, actually, 2.5 hours. I'm 2 hours from home, so we really appreciate that. Members and Mr. Chair, Senate File 196, there is an amendment, Mr. Chair, that I'd like to offer at this, or excuse me, have somebody offer, if somebody would be so kind. It would be the A1 amendment also.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, this is your first stop, right? So this would be an author's amendment?
That's correct.
All right, Ms. Pontius is indicating there's a typo in the amendment.
Yes, I did.
So let's get that corrected as well. What amendment are we looking at?
Mr. Chairman, it's the 196A-1.
Let's see if we can find it here.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Just an inquiry, since there's no one else at the desk and you can't make a motion. As chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen is dependent on me to make the motion for his delete or his author's amendment. Is that correct?
Now's your chance, Senator Limmer, but we don't have a quorum present.
Well, I'm thinking about it, Mr. Chair.
Well, Senator Ingebrigtsen can work out whatever you feel is necessary. But I think we need to wait until we have a. So why don't we proceed with taking information about it, and President will go through the formalities.
Thank you, and members, I'll be brief. This Please. Representative Cornish brought me a situation which is before you here, which is rather in my life, in 35 years, and being a law enforcement former sheriff, I'd never come across anything like this, and it was very intriguing to me that we had not had this covered. And so basically what it is in a nutshell, I think you have the well-prepared inherits rights in homicide cases, Senate File 196 information there, if you want to go through that. But basically what it is in generalities, and I'll let the testifier talk, there was a homicide, if you will, back in 2010 where the assailant was charged with the murdering, I believe it was her husband, and that case went on for a period of nearly 2 years or possibly even longer than that before there was a conviction. During that time, Mr. Chair and members, the way I understand it, and again, I'm going to let the testifier testify to this, the family of the assailant's family actually took control of the property, disposed of the property, leaving basically the victim's family members totally out of the picture of any properties and any rights of properties. Now, generally, what it's covered under the statute of 524.2. This would be in addition to that. This would actually basically say is that during the duration of a charge, if there is a pending charge for homicide, suspected homicide, that a member of the family or a member of the deceased, the member of the deceased family can actually ask for a court order pointing out properties that are owned by the decedent's family, and that judge then can order that actually, if you will, suspended or would put it into a situation in law where nobody would be able to disperse that property until the conviction was complete. Also in this bill, you'll see that protecting the rights of the assailant is also included in this particular bill. I think on page, if you will allow me, page 3, where you have a situation where somebody would be out on bail and still charged, that reasonable expenses could be incurred by that suspect at that time or the person charged, but again, would not be able to dissolve the property of the at that time the alleged victim. So there is a mechanism in place if the person were to be released during the trial period. So with that, maybe you want to hold questions till after the testifier testifies. I'd like to introduce to you the sister of the person that was the person of deceased. Her name is Leslie Nebe Johnson, and she's from Blue Earth County. This actually happened in Blue Earth County in August 2010, and Mr. Chair and members, I will turn her testimony over to you if I could.
Thank you. Welcome to committee, ma'am. If you would also state your full name for the
Thank
record.
You. My name is Leslie Nebe Johnson, and I appreciate you having me here. I did have something prepared. I'm much more eloquent when I have time to read something prepared, but it's my understanding that we don't have a lot of time. So in a nutshell, my brother was James Nibby. He was murdered by his wife in August of 2010 while he was sleeping. She was arrested 10 days later for the murder. She had stated in those 10 days to my mom that she had no idea how she would pay for the funeral. There was no life insurance, and she didn't know what she was going to do. After she was arrested, we were told that he did indeed have a very large life insurance policy that she was sole beneficiary of. We had asked her father. She confessed to the murder 24 hours after she was arrested, and her father and my family were both informed of the confession. We asked her father that day if we could collect some sentimental and personal property of my brother. That's all that we had been seeking ever. We never went after marital property. We were simply looking for his clothing, his golf clubs, his watch, his things that were of grave importance to us. He said, of course, provide me a list of things that you are interested in, and I will talk to her, and I will turn them over to you. 2 years later, $20,000 spent on attorney's fees, we got maybe 50% of the list back, and that was fighting him tooth and nail to get it. I had been asked to be appointed PR of his estate. After she was arrested, and I was blocked by her from jail, she wanted her father to be appointed to his estate instead. That should never happen. I would like to see that a person that is being detained for a murder, no one in their family be even looked at as PR of the estate. It should go to the family of the victim. We had asked for Jim's golf clubs for a golf tournament that we had held in his honor months after his murder. We couldn't get those. Her dad wouldn't even turn those over to us. We went through attorneys to get them, and finally he did turn them over to us, stating that we had to return them immediately after the golf tournament. It is difficult to articulate the frustration eloquently for me, the manipulation and the pain that her father was able to put us through simply because we had no rights. Just added to the agony and suffering that our family went through. My dad passed away before any of this ever finalized. We never got any of Jim's property back. and has been something horrible to go through. It's bad enough to lose someone, but then you lose someone to murder, and then you have to struggle for 2 years to get a pair of tube socks back. It's really sad. We saw items of Jim's clothing show up at thrift stores. Her father was getting rid of stuff, but then telling us that he didn't have it, he never had possession of it, and he was never held accountable in the four court orders that I saw. I was taking all of the appropriate avenues to get this property back, but was not getting anywhere because the current laws that are in place don't do anything for the families of the victims. And so I guess that's, in short, why we're here. You know, I would like to see something changed to protect future families of victims trying to recover sentimental personal property.
Nibby Johnson, thank you. Testimony, I'm sure it's difficult, some of this. Appreciate your being here. I will note there is a quorum present now. Senator Limmer, consideration of whether you're going to accommodate Senator Ingebrigtsen here. And
yes, Mr. Chair. I would like to move, is it the A1 amendment? I don't have it before me, so I don't know.
Yeah, so let's have Ms. Pontius tell us what the typographical errors that needs to be corrected.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, it's just on page 1, line 2, indictment. It should be I-N-D-I-C-T-M-E-N-T, not I-T-E.
Senator Limmer, is that amendment acceptable to you?
I haven't seen the amendment, but let's move it anyway, Mr. Chair. I move, I think it's an A1, is it an A1 amendment to Senate file number 196?
Some authors' amendment. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Amendment's adopted.
Thank you.
Now, Senator Ingebrigtsen, would you explain to us what the A1 amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Limmer, for that. And members, the A1 amendment, as amended with the typo, is basically law enforcement through the OJP, Office of Justice programs, through the Department of Public Safety, is issued cards, if you will, that dictate victims' rights when they're a victim of a crime. And in talking with and conversing with the director of that particular area, Jerry Bouvier, I'm thinking everybody probably is very familiar with her. Maybe she's here today. And the Department of Public Safety, they asked that we not implement, therefore not financially having to have any fiscal note, not implement this particular section or this particular statute until those are used up by law enforcement statewide. I think it was a good way to utilize the it still would be state statute effective as it says on the bill. If passed, however, the law enforcement wouldn't have to have that particular thing on their card that they hand out, that they have apparently an awful lot of, until the enacted date on this amendment, which is July 2014.
All right, so let's make sure there's no fiscal note on the bill. Are there any questions for Ingebrigtsen? Or discussion with the Senator Limmer, would you like to move the bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move that Senate file 196 as amended be recommended to pass and move to the floor.
Any further requests? Any further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair.
Sent to the floor.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you very much for your knowledge. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Safe drive back. Okay.
Thank you.
Senator Goodwin?
It's up to you.
Senate File 187? Those of you, before we start, for those of you who arrived to the committee room late, we will not be taking up Senate File 5. Taking up Senate File 33, the debt collector, for lack of time during today's meeting. We anticipate taking those bills up on Tuesday instead. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My bill is Senate File 187, and I think I'd like to put an author's, very small author's amendment on before I begin to explain the bill.
Is that the A1 amendment?
Yes, it's the A1 amendment, and it is page 1, line 21, after victim, insert or one of the victims.
All right, this being the first stop, amendment's appropriate. Senator Goodwin moves the A1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill takes aim at the financial exploitation of vulnerable adults. It seems like every other day there's a newspaper headline about financial crimes, and particularly against elderly victims. Here in Minnesota, we have done a lot of work to define, prevent, and respond to financial exploitation. Leadership on this issue has come from the Vulnerable Adult Justice Project, and that's the source of this bill. Iris Freeman is its coordinator, and she'll talk to you briefly about the background. And Mary Lynch, an assistant Hennepin County attorney, will describe the aggregation and venue provisions in the bill and why they are needed. And I'm happy to note that the companion file, House File 90, was passed by the Public Safety and Judiciary Committees of the House, and it has no fiscal impact, and it's awaiting a House floor hearing, which is expected next Monday. I will now turn it over to Iris Freeman. She can explain maybe a little more of the detail. All right.
Ms. Freeman, welcome to the committee. Please identify your name for the record and be sure to sign the sign-in sheets.
I shall do that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator Goodwin, and members. My name is Iris Freeman. I'm Associate Director of the Center for Elder Justice and Policy at William Mitchell College of Law. My professional background is in social work, and I have worked in the field of elder abuse prevention services and policy for something in excess of 35 years. The center plays host to the Vulnerable Adult Justice Project, which is a statewide collaborative of law enforcement, social service, health care, and advocacy groups, public agencies, and private associations. There should be a long list of those participants in a handout in your packets. Since 2007, we have been meeting monthly to work on issues of abuse, neglect, and exploitation, to build community awareness, to improve practice, and to strengthen laws by consensus of our group. We took a great number of steps in the direction of strengthening laws around financial exploitation back in 2009, thanks to the leadership of many on this committee. That is the background. Senate File 187 had its start in the Criminal Code Working Group of the Vulnerable Adult Justice Project, and Mary Lynch will talk with you about the substance of the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Lynch, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mary Lynch. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney. I'm speaking to you today as a member of the Vulnerable Adult Justice Project, which the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, along with a number of other organizations and stakeholders, participates. Senate File 187 has two provisions. The first is aggregation. It essentially clarifies the ability and mode of aggregation for the financial exploitation of vulnerable adults. The language deliberately mirrors the theft statute. It is consistent with how a variety of several of the different types of theft are aggregated in the sense that smaller offenses or individual acts by a suspect can be combined into single counts within a six-month period of time. For example, without aggregation, financial exploitation that constitutes 130,000 could be at best either one count or possibly even smaller misdemeanor counts, but with aggregation there would be the ability to aggregate separate counts. Yeah, this is consistent with theft statutes that cover similar behavior, in particular the financial exploitation statutes are crucial to prosecuting the subset of behavior. As Iris Freeman mentioned, the 2009 Vulnerable Adults Act clarified and really strengthened the criminal law, and aggregation will make making it clear that aggregation is available and the way to aggregate will make it available to address this behavior. In addition, placing the language, the aggregation language, within the financial exploitation statute, we believe will aid in prosecutors and judges, as well as other practitioners, both for the defense and prosecution, who might deal with this statute relatively infrequently, to make it much clearer for everybody and ultimately serve the public and everybody is impacted by the offenses. I would emphasize that we see this as a clarification refinement of the Vulnerable Adult Act, the 2009 Act, and its definitions of financial exploitation. The second statute addresses venue. This is a different concept. The idea behind adding the venue portion of the statute is that investigations often happen across jurisdictions, and it's often very difficult in this particular type of offense to determine where actual transactions occurred, and that is very much complicated by the fact that the vulnerable adults, frequently seniors, are living in a new county or a new place, and a place where frequently their family, the person who is caring for them, and very frequently the person who's actually committing the financial exploitation. And so having the venue be a little bit more flexible, which would allow the prosecution to happen in either where the actual act of the offense occurred or where the vulnerable adult lives at the time of the investigation, would allow prosecutors to address the harm that is met much more effectively. I think it's also important to note that a major part of the Vulnerable Adult Justice Project's impetus on this this proposal is to try to sync up the criminal process better with the adult protection system. There is a real clear statutory process for common entry point and then what entity and what agency investigates on the adult side. That link is a lot more difficult to find and follow in criminal prosecutions. So we would hope that there would be more efficient prosecutions and more efficient ability for investigators to work with prosecutors in the county that makes the most sense, as well as the adult protection folks that are closest to the investigation. In addition, I think with other venue modifications, other statutes that modify venue in the criminal code, the ability to have witnesses and victims be able to participate in a prosecution is real important. When the actual transactions involved and the residence of the victim and the other witnesses are far apart, that can significantly complicate both investigations and prosecutions. Our hope with changing this, creating a little bit of flexibility with the venue would actually result in more efficient investigations overall when looking at civil and criminal investigations, and hopefully provide a much better source of protection for a population that essentially has a very difficult time even understanding that they're victimized frequently, and that is one of the greatest challenges. I would note that the specific language of the venue portion is intended to more or less track with the identity statute, which also allows for some flexibility of venue prosecution.
Ms. Lynch, could you, with regard to that venue language, could you also help us understand how that squares with the constitutional provisions relating to venue?
Yes, as I'm sure you are aware, Mr. Chairman and committee members, venue in Minnesota is usually under the criminal code in the county where the act occurred or where the offense occurred. Venue is modified in some places to make it clear that venue can lie. And venue, this is venue for prosecution, which is a separate issue. But venue for prosecution can reside in places that are connected to the offense, to the crime, but may not as neatly sync up. Identity theft is one of those because in that case in particular, I believe part of the impetus there was the witness issue, the victim witness issue of being able to be prosecuted where they're feeling the impact. In our case, we believe that the harm, that is an issue, but also the fact that the harm is being perceived and felt is a really important piece. Another statute that is similar is the child abuse statute, which is there's a venue modification in 627.15. That statute has been litigated specifically with the constitutional issue and found to be constitutional. So we believe that the fact that there are other similar statutes and that at least one of those has been engaged in pretty significant litigation does address the constitutional issue.
Thank you. Do you have anything further to present, Senator Goodwin?
No, but I just want to say the bill has bipartisan support, and I want to thank the co-authors, Chair Latz and Senator Limmer and Senator Ortman.
Any further questions or discussion relating to the bill? We have in our packet, is this the same bill here? There's no fiscal note, as I understand. Is that correct?
The fiscal, Mr. Chairman, members, if I may, the fiscal note that I saw in the handouts was drawn to the House Companion, which is in...
It's identical language?
Identical.
So we have a fiscal note. It shows no fiscal impact. Any other committees have requested this bill? Okay, then.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the bill.
Senator Goodwin moves that Senate File 187 be recommended to pass and be referred to the floor of the Senate. Discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. No opposition. The bill passes and is referred to the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Franz's bill, Senate File 249. We are going to be handing the bill out to the members right now.
We just need to put it to the
floor. Okay. Members, there is a copy of Senate File 249 in your packets, and there's another one author's amendment as well. And welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Good afternoon. My name is Melissa Franzen, Senator Franzen, and I'm today presenting Senate File 249 for your consideration. And I do have the author's amendment that you should be having, and it just adds some technical corrections to the bill.
Senator Franzen, let's add that to the bill so it's in the shape that we're having for discussion. Senator Dietzek offers the A1 amendment as an author's amendment. Is there any discussion or questions about it? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Franzen, your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Currently, property deeds only allow one address to be listed on in order to receive a property statement in the mail. In estate planning, upon a person's death, property that is transferred by transfers on death deeds, by joint tenancy survivorship deeds, and by life estate deeds have no way of changing the address on record to reflect that of the new property owner who has inherited the property. Thus, they continue to be sent to the deceased property owner's address. In order to alleviate this estate planning burden and to ensure that property taxes are timely paid by the proper person, this bill allows the use of a tool called the Affidavit of Survivorship to streamline the process. The bill also allows the partial release of mortgages and includes other technical changes to replace outdated acronyms. With that, I will turn it over to Mr. Kevin Dunleavy, who is an attorney and member of the Minnesota State Bar Association Real Property Section, who can elaborate on these technical changes.
Mr. Dunleavy, welcome back.
Mr. Chair, thank you. excuse me. Okay, so with the affidavits of survivorship, what happens there is the transfer in the real estate tax records doesn't occur until the affidavit of survivorship is recorded. So the tax statements end up going to the previous owner, the decedent, whether it's a a transfer on death deed or an affidavit or a joint tenancy or a life estate. So now with the tax information being included in the affidavit of survivorship, the county auditor will change the taxpayer on the county records, and then the tax statements will go to the right people, which that's good for everybody. I mean, the people that are dead don't want to get the tax statements anymore, and their survivors would rather have them in the right name. The satisfactions, this is a codification of existing practice. Right now, if there's a development and there's 50 lots in it, as the lots are sold off, the mortgage will get partially paid, and the lot will get released, but there's no statutory authority for that process. So that's what this does. And then the CICT, as Senator Franzen mentioned, that's an obsolete acronym, and so we're just correcting that to make it the current acronym. The old one was Common Element Certificate of Title, and we're changing it to Common Interest Community Certificate of Title for Torrance property. And I think that's it.
Thank you, Mr. Dunleavy. Mr. Chair, do we have any questions from members? We'd be happy to answer them.
Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Senator Franzen, and maybe you or Mr. Dunleavy can answer this. Regarding an affidavit of survivorship, I can understand where that would apply to a living human being, but what about in the interest of a corporation being a party to this? Does it apply or does it not apply?
No. Corporations don't die like humans do. Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer. And so the corporate entities typically aren't grantees on a affidavit or, excuse me, on a joint tenancy deed, or they don't reserve life estates, and they're not transferees on TODs, on transfer on death deeds. I suppose theoretically they could be, but I've never seen it, and I don't know what that would do if it did happen.
Okay. I don't have any other questions, Mr. Chair.
Are there any other questions of Mr. Dunleavy or Senator Franzen?
Hearing none.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, on page 6 of the bill, there's a reference to a change in an acronym, CICCT. I missed it. Is there a definition of what that is?
Mr. Dunleavy.
I believe that's in the Torrens Act, which is Chapter 5, 508 and 508A. But the acronym, what it means is Common Element Certificate of Title. So if you've got a condominium, there's a separate certificate of title for the common area. That's owned by the association. It's not owned by an individual owner. And so that was called Common Element Certificate of Title at one time in the Torrens Act, and maybe 5 years ago the terminology changed, but the concept stays the same. It's the certificate of title for that, for the common areas in a condo.
All right, seeing no further questions.
So bill goes straight to the
floor. So, Senator Sharon, Senate File 249.
We recommend it pass and be referred to the Senate
floor. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion to
bills. Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Stay right there. We'll
take your
pleasure.
Just to announce for the record, we will, in fact, proceed with Senate File 345, Senator Goodwin's bill. Even though her testifier had to leave, Senator Goodwin has decided that she would like to move forward with the bill today.
Mr. Chair, is this the first time that Senator Franzen has presented a bill before the Judiciary Committee?
This Senator Limmer. She has not provided donuts.
Easy peasy.
No donuts, huh?
No donuts.
And the next one's a banker bill anyway. So.
Duly noted.
Consequence for the absence of donuts.
Which one is your next one?
Okay, we now have before us Senate File 336.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Senator Franzen, is there an author's amendment on this bill that we should adopt?
There is not.
Okay. So go ahead and introduce your bill then.
Good afternoon again, and I'm pleased to present Senate File 336 for your consideration. This bill deals with an imminent gap in our state electronic funds transfer law stemming from the federal Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. I was planning to give you the background, but I do have an expert in the room here with me today, so I will defer to Ms. Karen Grandstand, and she is an attorney and shareholder at the firm of Fredrickson & Byron, and also chair of the MSBA, Minnesota State Bar Association Business Law Section, Executive Counsel, and co-chair of the Banking Law Committee. So needless to say, she's an expert in this field, and I will request for her to elaborate on the gap and the action needed.
Okay. Welcome, Ms. Grandstand. State your name for the record and be sure to sign the sheet. Chance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to appear before you today. As noted by Senator Franzen, the proposed legislation is needed to essentially fill a gap in the law as it relates to certain commercial funds transactions. Under current law, generally, commercial funds transfers are covered by Article 4A, and consumer transfers are covered by the Federal Electronic Funds Transfer Act. Dodd-Frank changed that general legal scheme. There is a provision in Dodd-Frank amending the Federal Electronic Transfer Act to cover international fund transfers called remittance transfers. And as a result, both the Dodd-Frank Act and the implementing regulations that were issued by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau make certain commercial or wholesale transactions subject to the Electronic Funds Transfer Act, even though that act doesn't apply to them because those transactions don't meet the definition of an electronic fund transfer. So in other words, neither federal nor state law will cover certain transfers. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has acknowledged that one of the consequences of having these international remittance transfers subject to the federal law is legal uncertainty under the UCC for certain transfers. So the CFPB has declined to resolve this uncertainty, and they have stated that the best mechanism for resolving that issue rests with the states. They want the states to amend their respective versions of the UCC Article 4A. Now, the proposed legislation that's before you today is supported by the Uniform Law Commission, by the American Law Institute, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and CHIPS. And CHIPS, by the way, is the Clearinghouse Interbank Payment System. I am not personally aware of any opposition to this proposed legislation. So therefore, I would respectfully request that the Senate Judiciary Committee vote favorably on Senate File 336. And further, in terms of timing, I'd like to point out that it's very important that these amendments be enacted before the Electronic Fund Transfer Act amendment goes into effect or as soon as possible thereafter. The amendment to the Electronic Funds Transfer Act was originally going to become effective on February 7th. However, on January 22nd, the CFPB delayed the effective date pending finalization of a proposal that they issued the end of December. And they have indicated that when they finalize their December proposal, they will set a new effective date for the amendment to the Electronic Funds Transfer Act.
So we don't know when that will be.
We don't know when that is, other than the CFPB, as I noted, had originally set January or February 7th, and they have stated that they're going to move with haste to approve the December proposal and set an effective date.
This doesn't have an effective date on it.
So, Senator Franzen, the bill itself does not have an effective date on it, which means it would default to August 1st this year. Do we need to add an earlier effective date, such as a day following final enactment?
Yes, we should, Mr. Chair. So, can I
amend the amendment that I originally, well, I didn't have one for this one, I apologize. How would be most effective?
Separate amendment. Senator Hall?
So do, yes.
It's an oral amendment.
So do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Senator Hall.
So do.
That Senate File 336 be amended to reflect effective date following final enactment. In favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion fails. Are there any further amendments to Senate File 336? Are there any special questions for Senator Franz about the legal substance of Senate File 336?
Oh, yeah.
Senator Franz, and you're getting a very from this committee.
I appreciate it, Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Since I always have a question about uniform acts, would Senator Franzen be able to explain the effect of a uniform act in regard to this issue in relationship to other states that don't and have not instituted a uniform act regarding this issue?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, I will defer to Ms. Grandstand, but I know that there are other states that are actually pursuing this type of amendment to deal with this gap.
And that is correct. It's my understanding that legislation has actually at this point been approved in New York and introduced in California, Pennsylvania, and Hawaii. And so the intent is to have it approved across the country.
Mr. Chair, I see that Mr. Tennyson is in the room, and I notice that he brings forward a lot of uniform acts for us to consider. did I get the impression that only four or five states have actually passed this uniform act? Are there more? Or how uniform is this uniform act?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer.
Senator Tennyson.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Robert Tennyson, Attorney of Minneapolis. I'm Uniform Law Commissioner. This is the first year the act is being presented. It's on an expedited basis. I think the last report I had has been introduced in about 40 states already this year. It's being passed this year because of the need. I don't have how many have passed yet, but it's being acted on right now in 40 states or more.
So, Mr. Chair, so I understand this right. 40 states have introduced this Uniform Act for consideration, but you don't know the total number of the states that have actually enacted it.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is a technical change that was proposed last summer by the Permanent Editorial Board of the Uniform Commercial Code. And it was approved by the ALI, and it was also approved by the conference this year. It's a necessary change in the law if we're going to have uniformity in this area and preserve the role of the states in enforcing or providing a basis of law for these transactions. So I suspect by the end of the year, almost every state will have adopted it.
Assuming that those other 40 or so states counterpart to Senator Limmer, smoothly.
Well, I noticed, Mr. Chair, I happen to be, for some reason, I don't know how this happened, I'm a co-author on this bill. I may have more questions later in the process.
It's getting wiser as the years pass. Seeing no further discussion on Senate File 336, Senator Sharon?
No, I'm with you.
All right.
Are you hinting for a motion, Mr. Chair?
Take it on. This is going to be a vigorous floor debate, I can tell, too. Senator Franzen will have to handle the floor debate.
I'll move Senator Franzen's bill.
Senator Goodwin rises to the rescue. He rises to the rescue. And moves the Senate File 336 as amended. Be recommended pass and be referred to the floor. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye opposed. Motion prevails.
I didn't understand what you said.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you. We will now take on Senate File 335. Senator Goodwin.
45. Mr. Chair.
Sorry, 345.
Mr. Chair, it's always important for members to understand the subtleties of the chair from time to time. You're new, and some of our members are new too.
I didn't
too subtle.
I didn't get the invitation, Senator.
Senator Goodwin, Senate File 345. You have an author's amendment, is that right?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin moves her author's amendment A1. Say aye.
Aye.
Aye opposed. Motion prevails. Senator Goodwin, your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this bill gives restitution on behalf of a deceased victim. So if a victim dies before they're able to get restitution for a crime that was committed against them, then they are there's a personal representative is allowed to make a claim for a restitution or request restitution, and the heirs would be able to get restitution should there be restitution awarded. So it's as simple as that.
So, Senator, let me see if I can understand this correctly.
Copy of this definition.
Right now, if there's a person who's a victim of crime, they die, their right to recover restitution from the perpetrator of the crime dies with them. Is that right?
That's exactly right, Mr. Chair.
And the purpose of your bill is to not benefit the criminal perpetrator and to allow that right of restitution to survive the victim's demise. Is that right?
That's exactly right, Mr. Chair.
Otherwise, if restitution were owed an amount of $10,000 or whatever the number is, could be $200, and the victim were to die, then the criminal, person's convicted of the crime, would be absolved of their restitution obligation and could not have to pay that money under current law. Is that?
That's exactly correct, Mr. Chair.
It's inaccurate.
Mr. Chair? Who does the money then go to, the restitution?
Senator Goodwin?
Mr. Chair and Senator Hall, it then goes to the heirs.
The estate?
Excuse me. Right.
Good.
And this would clarify that the judges have the authority to make sure that happens. I suppose some of them felt they didn't have the authority to do that. It seemed to be the right thing to do.
That is exactly correct, and so it doesn't let the victor, the perpetrator, off the hook. They still have to pay restitution, it's as simple as that. There still has to be restitution paid if it's awarded, or it can be requested if it's not awarded, and then they can the money goes to the estate.
Senator Goodwin, I understand that current law does include family members of the deceased. But if there's some other personal representative of the estate, for whatever the reason may be, that's not included in current law, and wish for the estate in whatever form to be able to receive the restitution.
Correct, Mr. Chair. So if there are no family members surviving, but if there's a will or something that gives the estate to somebody else other than a family member, then they can apply for this restitution, or they can receive the restitution.
Or even in a probate estate with no will at all. Same effect?
Exactly, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does this then say that it automatically goes to the estate, or they have to apply for it?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
Either way, they can apply for restitution, or if there's restitution granted already, for example, before the person dies, there's been an order for restitution, then that would automatically go to the estate. If there hasn't been restitution awarded yet, and maybe the case isn't complete, but there is a request for restitution can be made at that point. So it covers either way.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if the person dies and they don't give the restitution to the estate, I guess I'm a little confused here. Does it automatically go to the state, or if the state doesn't do it, then they have to apply for it? Maybe legal counsel gives us that. What does it exactly say there?
Ms. Bonias?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Hall, I think all this is really intended to do is to give the personal representative kind of standing, so to speak, in a case where, you know, there hasn't been anything done. There's not an order, or else there is an order, and they can actually enforce it. I mean, arguably they have this power under current law, or could have. It's not entirely clear. You know, if there's already a judgment for restitution, it seems like that would be part of the estate. So this makes it clear that the personal representative can actually enforce that judgment. If for whatever reason there wasn't one in place already, then they could actually go to the court. I mean, they're still going to have to prove up the case just like the victim would. They'd basically be standing in the victim's shoes when they go into court and prove the case and then get an award, and then they could enforce it. So.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, it's clarifying then what already exists, that they do have that standing to do that?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I don't know what the practice has been, if it's been an issue in cases, and this just makes it clear that this is, in fact, something that they can do even though they're technically not in the definition of a victim, because right now it specifically refers to family members of the deceased, but not the personal representative of the deceased. So.
Okay. Sounds great.
Further discussion on Senate File 345. Senator Goodwin.
Mr. Chair, I don't know of anybody that's requested this bill in another committee. I have not heard. Perhaps,
Senator Goodwin,
Chair.
Our understanding is that there's been no request.
Okay.
The floor from here.
Then, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate File 345. I would like to again say that this is a bipartisan bill, and thank my co-authors, and that's Senator Hall and Senator Pappas. Thank you.
Seeing no further discussion, Senator Goodwin moves that Senate File 345 be recommended pass and referred to the floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
To come before the committee. We have some announcements to make real quick here. Next week, we will meet on Tuesday and Thursday. Each of those days, we will meet from noon till 2:30 and again from 6 until 9 p.m. We're also planning to meet Friday from noon until 6 p.m. Thursday and Friday hearings will be on bills related to guns. As I said before, when we were talking about scheduling, we're trying to balance our schedule out so that we don't get all bunched up at the end of deadline weeks, and we don't have to meet every night the last few weeks before deadline. So better to fit a few in now and keep the bills moving. So nothing further before the committee. We are adjourned.